This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Portland Airport appears in court today.
A new report shows a potentially illegal relationship between the State Department and Monsanto.
Clothing retailers come under fire for their unsafe practices in Bangladesh clothing factories.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 14th, 2013. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Alex Ward. A ballot filled with white powder was discovered yesterday at the Multnomah County Elections Office. Slightly after 4 p.m., Portland Fire and Rescue arrived on the scene. The building was evacuated and the ventilation system was disabled as a precautionary measure. According to a press release from the fire department, dangerous substances such as anthrax were ruled after an initial investigation from their hazmat team. The workers who came in contact with the substance showed no symptoms. Because the incident took place at an election facility, the ongoing investigation has been transferred to the FBI. Beth Ann Steele, a public affairs specialist from the Portland FBI office, told KBOO that their investigation is ongoing and will likely conclude by the end of the week. KBOO will have more on this story as it develops.
Lots of people will be drinking water without say whether or not there's fluoride in it if a city-sponsored ballot measure passes. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
Half a dozen water districts outside of Portland have voiced their opposition to plans by the city to place a fluoridation measure on the ballot. Maywood Park, Gresham, Tualatin Water District, and Rockwood People's Utility District, among others, will be forced to drink fluoridated water if the measure passes, even though those communities in general oppose fluoridation. Mike Rosenberger, who is president of the Rockwood People's Utility District, said the members of the board of his district made their feelings about the Portland measure very clear.
They were not at all pleased and are still not at all pleased about the way the decision was made unilaterally by the city of Portland. And the fact that the Portland City Council did not include Rockwood or any of Portland's other wholesale water purchasers.
Mr. Rosenberger said Rockwood, as well as many of the other entities, buy their water from Portland and shouldn't have to be forced to drink fluoridated water. He said his board member sent a letter to the city in protest of the measure.
Our board sent a letter to the city council making its feelings clear, and most other entities in the area that purchase water from Portland did the same.
Todd Heigerken is a spokesperson for the Tualatin Valley Water District. He says that although board member Richard Burke was quoted as saying that it is wrong to deny over 350,000 Oregonians the right to have a board vote on whether or not their water is fluoridated, he says the district has no official position. But he too said the district made its feelings known to the city of Portland.
Yeah, there's been instances where we've expressed our interest in at least being a little bit more aware on what the initial action of the city council was with respect to their efforts to fluoridate, since a number of us would have to, in essence, abide or receive the result of that decision as well.
In some communities, different districts pay into a common pot, and that money is then used to store and distribute the water to all participating communities. Mr. Heigerken says Tualatin has two sources of water. One is from the city of Portland.
And so we are considered a wholesale customer, as are a number of other water providers in this region, where we have agreed through a water supply agreement to purchase water in a certain quantity from the city of Portland. And then within that agreement, it says that we will get the quality of water comparable to what is provided the city residents.
The other is a separate source.
That's a source that we actually are a part owner in. It's the Joint Water Commission out in there's a water treatment plant out in Forest Grove.
Okay. And there really is no way to keep the water sources separate when you're delivering that water to your water users, right?
True. There's an area in the middle where eventually those sources mix, yes.
But Mr. Rosenberger agrees that in the end, there really isn't very much that the district can do.
Well, if the measure passes, what kind of recourse do you guys have other than just to drink the water?
We actually have no recourse, I think, as a practical matter. I have not heard conversation among various elected officials, including those here, about what kind of action there might be. I think we're looking at it as a practical matter that we purchase water from Portland, and if Portland fluoridates the water, that's the water that we will buy.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
Housing costs as a percentage of income are increasing nationwide, and in Oregon, the costs are above the national average. In Oregon, one in four families faces hardship due to rising housing costs this year, according to the Statesman Journal. About a quarter of working households are paying more than half of their income for housing, according to the Housing Landscape 2013 report from the Center for Housing Policy. That's 3% higher than the national average, ranking Oregon with New York, California, and Florida. The report says that this is because income rates in the state are simply not keeping up with rising housing costs.
Oregon Senate Bill 558 passed through a work session in the State House today without comment. The foreclosure mediation bill eliminates a loophole in a previous law that allowed banks to avoid foreclosure mediations by filing judicial foreclosures. Non-judicial foreclosures move much faster than judicial ones and give both parties a chance to request a mediation where they must meet face-to-face. The loophole became a problem after the Oregon Court of Appeals ruled in 2012 that mortgage lenders could not avoid publicly recording deeds of trust by recording them with the private company Mortgage Electronic Registry Systems, or MERS. Since the ruling, only 8 foreclosure mediations have been held in as many months. Instead of mediation, the vast majority of foreclosure proceedings are being run through the court system with little input from homeowners, and in some cases, owners are unaware of proceedings until they receive a summons. The current bill closes the loophole by allowing homeowners at risk of default to request mediation before foreclosure proceedings are filed, as well as requiring lenders to request mediation before taking action. The bill makes a number of other smaller changes as well in an effort to streamline and shorten the often painful process.
According to a 20-page report released by Food and Water Watch today, the U.S. State Department has spent millions of taxpayer dollars as a global biotech ambassador. The report describes the State Department's aggressive effort to globally promote seed industry companies. From 2005 to 2009, the State Department forwarded nearly 1,000 cables and sent emissaries to 170 conferences to promote companies like Monsanto, DuPont, Bayer Crop Science, and Dow Agrochemical through collaborative efforts with U.S. embassies. Approximately one of every 8 cables from 42 nations addressed mandatory labeling for genetically engineered food products, which the U.S. opposes out of concern labels might imply lack of food safety. Activists opposed to genetically modified organisms in global food supplies plan to protest biotech titan Monsanto later this month. Demonstrations will be held in 7 Oregon locations. Here is Scott Bates of GMO Free Oregon with more about the event planned for Portland's Holiday Park on May 25th.
May 25th has become a global day of action, if you will, a march against Monsanto. It's all about raising awareness, basically, just for, you know, you can still go on the street and say the name Monsanto, and plenty of people don't know who that is or what that means. And so, you know, there's marches in 36 different countries or more that are being organized for this. Here in Oregon, there's at least 5 different marches: Portland, Eugene, Grants Pass, Medford, Coos Bay, Prineville, Redmond. Portland's event is at Holiday Park on Saturday the 25th. I believe it's 11 a.m. is start time. And, you know, there'll be a rally beforehand, nation booze and all that kind of stuff. And I'll march through the streets of that area town. I believe it's March Against Monsanto, mampdx.com. We'll have more info about it. So check it out and please come out.
That was Scott Bates of the group GMO Free Oregon.
Yesterday, the Oregon House held a public hearing about Senate Bill 835, which prohibits the act of horse tripping. Horse tripping is the practice of catching a horse by his front or back legs while galloping, which causes the animal to trip and fall. The sport is often featured in charreada, a form of rodeo associated with Mexican culture. KBOO's Audrey Davis has more.
During yesterday's hearing, several people testified in opposition to the bill. Many argued that horse tripping does not cause direct injury to the horses and is a harmless source of entertainment. Robert Miller, a lawyer from Eugene, expressed concern about the future of the rodeo without this event.
This is just the first little chink of the armor. So they're going to find a sympathetic victim, which is horses, and they're going to try to carve a niche out. That's this year. What's it going to be like next year and the year after? You know, if this was such a bad event, why would these thousands of people year after year with great families, great people who you would like and always come to this events? If this was really cruelty to animals, the marketplace would wipe it out.
Francisco Navarro, a representative of the Charros Association of Oregon, says that prohibiting horse tripping will undermine Mexican rodeo culture.
In charreadas, we want to keep this heritage for our sons and grow together, because now many of our kids, they are not Mexicans, they are Mexican-Americans, and they got this tradition of USA, and they got this tradition from Mexico. And believe me, the horse is very important, and this practice is really, really part of us.
Those who opposed the bill were outnumbered by supporters of the bill, many of whom testified that horse tripping can lead to permanent defects in the horse. Cindy Burko, a citizen of Polk County, spoke in favor of the bill.
It's important to remember that the participants of this event are not necessarily horse trainers or vaqueros. Anyone who can scrape together the entry fee can rope a horse. And due to the number of amateur ropers participating, these terrified animals are too frequently injured or traumatized to the point that they are forever useless as working partners. Too many are ultimately destroyed.
Kendra Kimberascas, a citizen of Clackamas County, testified to the danger of this event.
The slightest injury to a leg, neck, or to the back can be a career ending for these magnificent animals. That is why I was horrified to learn that at some local unsanctioned rodeos, the sport of horse tripping was a regular and featured event. Horse tripping is cruel, unnecessary animal abuse and should be banned from all rodeos immediately. This will be traumatizing for the horses. The process of being chased and tripped is terrifying, and these young horses learn a deep-seated fear of people, making them unsuitable and unsafe as companion animals.
The bill will need to pass the Judiciary Committee before going to the full Oregon House for a vote. For KBOO News, I'm Audrey Davis.
The Oregon State Senate passed a bill this morning that bans employers from demanding that their employees friend them on Facebook. The bill, which goes back to the House for final approval, also stops employers from requiring that workers give them their social media passwords or otherwise accessing their social media accounts. Legal experts say that the employers could gain access to protected information like medical information, disabilities, political views, or sexual orientation. Employers have been sued for discriminating against employees for their use of legal products like alcohol and tobacco from information found on the workers' Facebook page. Here's a sampling of the testimony at today's Senate hearing in Salem.
As you know, the world has changed as it relates to how folks communicate in the world today. I was at a breakfast today where the breakfast gave a hashtag, and folks were tweeting back and forth around that hashtag, and those tweets were shown on the screen. The world today is different. This bill brings us into that 21st century universe. Individuals' privacy is important. This bill protects that privacy in the social media world. Colleagues, I would ask for your aye vote on this very important bill.
You may well remember that we did a similar bill related to student privacy around social media. And I would just like to remind you that in the old days, before electronic communications that have been so well described, it would have been unconscionable and unacceptable for an employer to ask to see your personal diary, your letters between you and your friends, anything like that. And today, Facebook, other social media sites are essentially the equivalent of that. So as my colleague said, I urge your aye vote on this important bill to protect people, and it's a great example of bipartisan bicameral cooperation.
The social media protection bill passed 28-1 in the state Senate this morning and will go on to the House for approval.
Seattle high school students have declared a partial victory in their campaign against standardized tests. Today, the Seattle Public School District announced they will not be administering the Measures of Academic Progress, or MAP, test to students next year. This past January, teachers at Garfield High School led the boycott of the MAP test, saying it was not an accurate representation of student progress and was a waste of time and money. They were quickly joined by parents and students, as well as teachers from other high schools, which led to international attention and support, including a boycott of the test in Portland schools. The MAP test, which is administered 2 to 3 times throughout the year will now be optional for high school students, but is still required for kindergarten through 8th grade.
A Portland man who stripped naked last year to protest an airport screening was back in court again today. The Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, is claiming that John Brennan was interfering with screening operations at the airport by being naked. He is fighting a $1,000 fine. Last April, Brennan took off all of his clothes at the airport security gate in Portland after a TSA got a false positive on a swab test. Local police were called and charged Brennan with indecent exposure. Last July, a state judge dismissed the charge and found that his action was protected as free speech by the United States Constitution. Despite the judge's ruling, the TSA is still seeking a $1,000 civil fine against Brennan for violating TSA regulations. Because this is considered a civil penalty, the TSA is not bound by the criminal acquittal. Brennan's only option for appeal was to request a formal hearing before an administrative law judge. The TSA convinced the court to bar cameras, but the hearing is still open to the public. After today's 5-hour hearing, Brennan's attorney told KABU that the judge's decision will not be available for 60 days. George J. Jordan, the administrative law judge in this case, is an employee of the Department of Homeland Security.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes director of the documentary Valentine Road, currently being viewed in Ashland, Oregon. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is a chance of rain with a high of 63 degrees.
It's 5:21. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
At last, some excellent economic news for folks long mired in the stagnant labor market. Jobs spring back, exclaimed a typical headline on recent reports that 165,000 private sector jobs were added in April. Wow, the thunderous 3-year boom of prosperity that has rained riches on Wall Street is finally beginning to shower on our streets, right? Well, as dryland farmers can tell you, thunder ain't rain. Read beneath the joyful headlines and you'll see the parched truth. For example, more than a third of working-age Americans are either out of work or have given up finding a job. Also, last month's hiring increase was almost entirely for receptionists, waiters, temp workers, car rental agents, and other low-wage positions. On the other hand, manufacturing, generally the source of good middle-class jobs, did not add workers in April and has cut some 10,000 jobs in the last year. Especially problematic was the continued rise in underemployment, people wanting full-time work but having to take part-time and temporary jobs. Underemployment is also pounding college graduates. While they've been more successful than non-grads at landing jobs, they're not getting jobs that fit their career goals or even require the degrees they spent money and time to obtain. Indeed, many of those rental agents and restaurant employees you encounter hold 4-year degrees, forcing everyone else to scramble for the few even lower-paid jobs further down the skill ladder. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, the next graduating class is about to flood into the labor market with nowhere to go. America's middle class is in a crisis, while our pathetic political leaders pretend that Wall Street's prosperity covers us all, and the corporate media puts little happy face stickers over the dark reality faced by the workaday majority.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The first unmanned training flight for a National Guard unit in U.S. airspace is scheduled for today. Oregon National Guard soldiers will pilot a drone as it flies near Pendleton. The flight is expected to last 1 hour. The drone will not fly over the city, according to a spokesperson from the Oregon National Guard. The Oregon Army National Guard has 5 drones and flies the 4 that are housed at its Boardman Station. The fifth the fifth drone is not flown and is not housed in the area. The Pendleton drones, which do not carry weapons, are shaped like airplanes, weigh 375 pounds, are 12 feet long, and have 13-foot wingspans. They are not allowed to fly over densely populated areas. City officials in Pendleton are optimistic that drones may bring high-tech jobs to the area. The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Department and others could fly drones out of the Eastern Oregon Regional Airport to spot fires, track salmon migration, locate lost hunters and hikers, and gather crop moisture information. The military uses drones because they can conduct surveillance without putting soldiers in harm's way. In a recent news release, the Oregon Army National Guard stated that they do not conduct surveillance on U.S. citizens.
Attorney General Eric Holder came under fire from journalists this morning, questioning his agency's decision to seize 2 months of phone records from the Associated Press. Here's a clip from that press conference in which Holder describes why he recused himself from that investigation.
I think I'm probably the only person who was recused, and I did so, as I said, out of an abundance of caution, because I would have been the person leading the investigation. And it just seemed to me that having been interviewed, having knowledge of the matter, and then interacting with the press, that it just seemed to me probably better for me to step out.
A lot of Americans say they don't trust the administration right now. What can you say to them that you can ensure that they should trust all of you?
Well, to the extent that we have determined that actors in government have gone beyond what they were supposed to do, broken regulations, broken rules, broken the law, we have prosecuted people. We have held people accountable. We have tried to do things according to the rules. There are going to be people occasionally who will not do so.
During the last administration, the president signed executive orders that effectively just continued what had already happened. You mentioned civil rights laws, but there are so many other examples where people are disappointed in this administration's civil liberties record, both on the left and the right. Do you need to change course, and aren't you trampling on civil liberties the same way the Bush administration did?
No, we're not. This administration has put a real value on the rule of law and our values as Americans. I think the actions that we have taken are consistent with both.
That was Attorney General Eric Holder speaking to reporters this morning. The Associated Press, or AP, says that over 100 of their journalists and editors were targeted by government officials who took over 2 months of phone records without giving the press agency a chance to appeal. For more on this story, KBOO's Sequoia Wright spoke with Marcy Wheeler, a blogger from EmptyWheeler.net.
What can you tell us about the journalists being spied on through the Obama administration?
The AP got a letter from the D.C. U.S. Attorney Ronald Machen on Friday, revealing that 20 of the phone lines from the AP, both in Washington, New York, Hartford, Connecticut, the Congressional House phone, their call records have been turned over to DOJ. We now know that was via subpoena. And that's the first the AP had heard about it. DOJ regulations normally say if you're going to do that, if you're going to subpoena journalists, you should give them notice first, unless it's going to completely blow up your investigation. DOJ and the AP have been squabbling back and forth all day about the scope of it, but one thing is clear is that the AP was not given any advance warning, and those records included not just the six journalists who were involved in the story. This was a story on May 7th, 2012, about a plot that the CIA had interrupted to bomb an underwear plot again, so to bomb a U.S.-bound aircraft, somebody wearing an underwear bomb. But it also included maybe up to 100 other journalists. Their records were also taken.
And has there been any other news outlets other than Associated Press that have been targeted as well?
We don't know. Attorney General Holder was asked that today. He's recused in the case, so he shouldn't be answering these questions anyway, and he did say in response to this question, that reporters should be asking the Deputy Attorney General, James Cole, who, with Attorney General's recusal, is now in charge of the case. But that he wouldn't answer no leads me to suspect there might be others. The actual worst part of the story, the one that was the most sensitive, was actually not even reported on AP. It was reported at ABC. So it'll be curious to learn whether they get subpoenaed under this as well.
So what is it that the administration is looking for? Why is it that they're targeting journalists? What kind of information are they looking for from these journalists?
It depends who you ask. They say they've had 550 interviews in this investigation already and haven't been able to figure out who the leaker, who the leakers behind this story actually are. And so now they're trying to go to the journalists and cross-reference who spoke to whom so they can go back and try and nail these sources.
Are journalists part of the regulations in the Patriot Act?
Well, you're talking several different things. In this case, we believe it was a normal administrative subpoena signed by the Deputy Attorney General. Normally, it'd be signed by the Attorney General. That's not reviewed by a court, mind you. And had DOJ actually warned the AP, they surely would have challenged the subpoena, and a judge would have been able to assess it, and I suspect that the subpoena would be pretty radically curtailed, if not thrown out altogether. But under the Patriot Act and under a number of other laws, there are other ways to get phone contacts. For example, you can use the DOJ in 2011 held that in certain national security investigations, they can get reporters' contacts without a subpoena via these other means, via this other kind of order, to phone companies. And then there's the collection that goes on via the NSA, which is very broad. And what comes into question there is when they go back into that big stash of collection and pull out American information. And hypothetically, they would do that with journalists in certain circumstances anyway, but that's not what we believe to have occurred in this case.
That was Sequoia Wright for KBOO News, speaking with noted blogger Marcy Wheeler from EmptyWheeler.net. In 2007, a Senate filibuster by Republican legislators prevented the passage of the Free Flow of Information Act, which would have forbidden federal investigators from compelling journalists to give evidence without first obtaining a court order. The bill included a section that specifically forbid the government from subpoenaing journalists' phone records. President Obama, who was a senator at the time, supported the bill, which would have prevented his administration from taking this action targeting the Associated Press.
Russian officials have ordered an American diplomat to leave the country in the wake of accusations that he tried to recruit a Russian officer to work as an agent for the United States. Reports regarding Ryan Fogel's arrest describe him as a third secretary with the U.S. Embassy, who was carrying wigs, sunglasses, cash, a letter to address to a, quote, dear friend, promising $1 million a year for ongoing services rendered. Russian authorities contend Fogel is actually an agent of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. Both U.S. Ambassador Michael McFaul and State Department spokeswoman Jane Psaki have refused to comment publicly on the matter. Both U.S. and Russian officials say this development won't get in the way of talks about how to deal with escalating tensions in Syria.
Nearly 700,000 civilian workers in the Pentagon have been ordered to take 11 unpaid leave days in the next 4.5 months. Today, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said that the Pentagon is $30 billion short in the accounts that pay most civilian employees for this fiscal year due to the congressionally mandated automatic budget cuts, known as the sequester. Hagel also said that even after these cuts are made, they will still be short of needed operating funds. He has ordered a review that could lead to additional cost-saving measures, such as reducing the number of generals, cutting back the civilian workforce, and moving to slow the spiraling costs of new weapons. The Pentagon is also urging Congress to move forward with a new round of military base closures. About 15% of the department's civilian workforce will be exempt from the furloughs. Exempt workers include civilians in war zones and in critical public safety jobs, as well as people whose jobs are not paid for through congressional funding. For example, some employees may be contractors or people working in facilities that pay for operations out of their earnings, including some jobs in recreation and foreign military weapon sales.
After the largest garment factory accident in history killed 1,100 people in Bangladesh 3 weeks ago, clothing chains that do business in Bangladesh have come under increased scrutiny. The Gap Clothing Company has declined to sign an accord to improve safety conditions in Bangladeshi factories. The legally binding agreement calls for frequent and detailed factory safety inspections with public reports and mandatory renovations. It also prevents retailers from doing business with factories that do not meet safety standards. Although the major Western retail brands have all denied connection with the factory that collapsed, human rights workers found labels from Benetton and other brands in the rubble. Under international pressure, many firms have decided to work to improve their own safety standards. Several European firms, such as H&M and Inditex, the owners of Zara, have announced their intention to sign the accord. In a statement released today, Gap says it will only sign the agreement if the section regarding how disputes are resolved in court is renegotiated. Companies have until tomorrow to sign the agreement to improve labor standards in Bangladesh. Walmart has also declined to sign the agreement so far. After the building collapsed, Walmart shut down its garment factory located 250 kilometers from Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. Walmart said yesterday that its inspectors found structural problems with a neighboring building that was not affiliated with the company. Due to these discoveries, Walmart asked its factory in Bangladesh to stop production until changes were made to the adjacent building. The factory closed for 4 days and saw no improvements made on the neighboring building. Walmart says they have removed all connections with this factory and asked that it remain closed until the safety concerns have been addressed. Despite the safety violation, the factory begins production again today.
A 2,300-year-old Mayan pyramid was bulldozed in northern Belize to extract materials for road building. Archaeologists discovered the destruction last Tuesday. Though the Nomal complex wasn't the most well-preserved, it was an unmistakable landmark in its otherwise flat surroundings, and one of the most important Mayan sites in northern Belize. Archaeologists are shocked at the apparent gross disrespect, and police are investigating for possible criminal charges. The site is located on private property, but pre-Hispanic sites are administered by the Belize government. Francisco Estrada Belli of the Tulane University Anthropology Department estimates that a Mayan mound is destroyed every day for construction purposes, and that the only way to stop such abuses is to treat them as major crimes.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, May 14th,